Good afternoon, you're listening to Engineer Afternoon here for Wednesday, the 19th of April of the year 2017. Jeff Brown with you today. We're getting an update about local book happenings at Hearthside Books with Brenda Weaver. We'll get an update on tonight's Alaska Design Forum. We'll learn about a new composting business in town. We'll discuss past prosperity. And Marion Call will fill us in the details with a Minicon family concert coming up this weekend. That writer's Almanac, Myrna, Music and More today on Engineer Afternoon. Well, the forecast for tonight, chance of rain, low temperatures in the mid-30s with light winds. Forecast for Thursday, chance of rain with high temperatures in the mid-40s. Thursday night, chance of rain. Friday, rain likely with high temperatures around 50 degrees.
This is National Native News. I'm Art Hughes, in for Antonio Gonzalez. The Kalispell tribe has filed a legal complaint in federal court. They're challenging the Bureau of Indian Affairs approval of the Spokane Tribe's casino project just 2 miles away from the Kalispell's Northern Quest Resort and Casino. The Spokane Tribe broke ground on the $40 million project last fall and intends to open the casino doors later this year. Steve Jackson reports.
Under the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, the Spokane Tribe's off-reservation casino required a positive determination that demonstrated the proposed casino would not be detrimental to the surrounding community. But the Kalispells contend their own casino operation in Airway Heights would be affected by a new casino in the community. They say their own essential social, health, educational, and public safety services funded by the Kalispell Casino would be reduced if the Spokane Casino is allowed. Spokane City Council President Ben Stuckard says the determination process was extensive and took 10 years. He believes not only was it thorough, but the Kalispell's argument of being hurt financially by the Spokane Casino, which is now under construction, doesn't seem to play out given that the Kalispells are also expanding their current operation.
Well, I think there's an expansion going on right now at their current location, and so if they were really concerned because construction has started on the STEP project, if it was going to hurt the existing if the business case was that it would hurt the existing business, I don't think we'd see an expansion happening right now.
Spokane Tribal Council Chair Carol Evans said in a statement that the Interior Department conducted a, quote, rigorous, comprehensive 10-year review process, and that the Kalispell Tribe's lawsuit, quote, boils down to an argument that the government is somehow required to insulate Kalispell's gaming monopoly against fair competition from us, the resident tribe, despite our significant unmet needs. Unquote. For National Native News, I'm Steve Jackson reporting from Spokane.
A Texas oil man is suing the federal government over a canceled lease in the Badger Two Medicine area south of Glacier Park in Montana. The lease is one of three leases the government canceled there, at least one of which is also disputed. Nate Hedgie reports.
The Badger Two Medicine area is a sacred site for the Blackfeet Nation.
We are supporting oil and gas development on the Blackfeet Reservation, just not in our sacred and cultural areas.
That's Tyson Running Wolf, secretary for the Blackfeet Tribal Council. He says the tribe offered the leaseholder, William Tex Moncrief, a chance to move his lease and explore other less sacred places on the reservation.
We were really interested in trying to sit down with them and work out some sort of deal, but they never ever answered us back, or it wasn't something that they were interested in doing prior to them leases being canceled.
In his lawsuit, Moncrief says the federal government was playing politics at the end of the Obama administration, instead of considering the historical merits of his lease, which was granted in the 1980s. The case has been assigned to the same federal judge in Washington, D.C. that's hearing a similar case involving Solonex LLC, another former leaseholder in the Badger Two Medicine area. They filed a lawsuit in 2013. For National Native News, I'm Nate Hedgie.
U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions is following through on measures his office says are aimed at supporting tribal law enforcement and public safety. A press release Tuesday outlined three actions aimed at boosting tribal police efforts. The department announced the creation of the Indian Country Federal Law Enforcement Coordination Group, which brings together a dozen federal organizations to help fight violent crime. The department is also organizing a series of listening sessions with tribal leaders and law enforcement officials. Some of the actions Sessions' office touted this week were actually started during the previous administration, including the expansion of the number of tribes who can access a federal criminal database. The inclusion of the 10 additional tribes using the database was announced the month before President Trump took office and is part of the 2010 Tribal Law and Order Act. With National Native News, I'm Art Hughes.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation. with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
The Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce's Convention and Touring Department welcomes the Gathering of Nations 2 Expo New Mexico, April 28th and 29th. Information on services and the Gathering of Nations at siabq.org.
Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for more than 30 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com. Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 6 minutes past the hour, and you're tuned in to June Afternoon. Our first guest is Brenda Weaver from Hearthside Books.
Hi, Jeff.
So you got a lot of stuff happening on in Hearthside Books land.
We do have a lot of things. Tis the season of Hearthside happenings. First thing is tomorrow night from 6:30 to 7:30, Bjorn Dila is going to be at the mall. He's going to be talking about his new book, Haunted Inside Passage. It's rapidly becoming one of our bestsellers.
Cool.
And you might know him. He's written several articles in the newspaper and things. And I'm really excited to be able to host him.
We talked to him about the book a few weeks ago on June Afternoon.
Yeah. We also have our author cruise coming up at the end of May, and we have an all-star lineup. Eowyn Ivey is going to be on board. Kate Troll, Mark Kelly, Bob Fagan, and Ishmael Hope so far. We're very excited to be able to bring Eowyn. She's got To the Bright Edge of the World is her latest book. She wrote Snow Child. And so she'll be coming down from up north to visit us. And, of course, there'll be the wine tasting with specialty imports and food on board. And it starts at, I think we board at 6 p.m. at Stater Harbor on the 26th, on Friday the 26th, and go for a three-hour whale-watching cruise and listen to great authors. And tickets are available at Hearthside.
And the 26th of April or May?
May, I'm sorry, 26th of May, yes. We're going to wait till the end of last day of school to celebrate. But we're very excited to have that coming up. And in between, you can catch us at the MiniCon this Saturday over at Jack with Pat Race and the Alaska Robotics crew. We'll be at the IDEA fair in the middle of May, and we will also, and I think it's amazing, David Sedaris coming to town, and we're partnering with K2, and it's my understanding that he does his shows only in conjunction with independent bookstores, so that's always exciting. Let's see, the beginning of April 29th is Independent Bookstore Day and International Tabletop Game Day. So we get a twofer at the stores. You're going to have story time, and we're going to have some fun games to play, a lot of writing activities, lots of fun things going on that day.
And what day is it?
That is April 29th. So we're going to start off this weekend with the MiniCon and then go into International Bookstore Day, and Children's Book Week is the first week of May. And then we go into the United Way cruise with Ray Troll. We're going to be at the IDEA Fair on the 11th. David Sedaris on the 14th of May. We have our third Thursdays every month. Our author cruise.
Any help with book clubs in town?
We have wonderful book clubs in town. And we are starting a Hearthside book club where we will offer 20% off of a selected book that we choose and then meet weekly. So if you want to sign up for that, you can pop in either store and put your name on the list.
What are you reading now?
What am I reading right now? I just finished Haunted Inside Passage. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I am reading David Sedaris' new book that's coming out right after he leaves here, and I did not get permission for pre-sales on that. So, unfortunately, it's actually a journal of his. So that's going to come out on May 30th.
What time of year is the busiest time for authors releasing books?
Generally, May and November seem very, very popular. They come out all year long, but May and November, it seems that we get the bulk of it.
Cool. So what else is happening?
What else is happening? Well, the cruise ships will be coming in town. Lots of construction to trip over downtown and watch out for the reverse flows that will be happening. We have our third Thursdays where we invite local authors, writers, storytellers, whomever, to sign up and come in and talk about their books. Mark Kelly's got a new book out, and Nick Jans. It's Juno's Mendenhall Glacier. Beautiful little book. And then we also have our story times. We're encouraging people to sign up to come in to read stories on Saturdays to children at both stores.
If people don't know where Hearthside Books is, could you tell us?
We are on the corner of Front and Franklin downtown, right by the clock, in the Triangle Building, and we are at the Nugget Mall out in the valley. Lots of new stuff coming in. It's a lot of fun.
If I asked you, what would be your favorite book?
What would be my favorite book? Let's see. It's usually whatever I'm currently reading, but I think, and it surprised me, but Lilac Girls. Or All the Light We Cannot See, and I'm really surprised because those are historical fiction, but they were so well written and such a pleasure to read.
All right. And you have a website.
And you can catch us at www.hearthsidebooks.com.
Cool. Brenda, do you have anything you'd like to add?
I would like to invite everyone to check out our posters that we put up daily, almost weekly, any of the ticket events, things like that. Also, I want to give a shameless plug for the Rotary speaker series, because the next one up, we were sold out on this one, so get your tickets for the next one. He is a phenomenal speaker.
Thanks a lot, Brenda.
Thank you, Jeff.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, the 19th of April, 2017. It's the anniversary of the beginning of the American Revolution at the battles of Lexington and Concord, fought on this date in 1775. 700 British soldiers had marched out from Boston to seize the colonials' military supplies and to try to capture John Hancock and Samuel Adams, who were in hiding. This was the march that Paul Revere was waiting in Boston to signal which way the British would come, as Longfellow wrote in his famous poem, "One if by land, and two if by sea, and I on the opposite shore will be, ready to ride and spread the alarm through every Middlesex village and farm, for the country folk to be up and to arm." The British regulars arrived in Lexington at about 5 in the morning. They found 77 colonial militiamen waiting for them. Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote his Concord hymn about it. "By the rude bridge that arched the flood, their flag to April's breeze unfurled. Here once the embattled farmers stood and fired the shot heard round the world." Nonetheless, the American militia lost that brief battle, but in Concord there was a larger force of colonials waiting, and though the British did destroy the arsenal, they were forced back to Boston under heavy rifle fire, and by the end of the day, the Revolutionary War had begun. It was on this day, 1824, the poet Lord Byron died while fighting with the Greeks in their war of independence from Turkey. He died of disease, not from warfare, but nonetheless Greece proclaimed him a national hero, and to this day Byron is still a popular name for boys in Greece. It's the birthday of the diarist Sarah Kemble Knight, born in Boston, 1666, who in 1704, she took a journey on horseback from Boston to New Haven and kept a very precise journal of her travels, which remains now one of the best documents and chronicles of how people lived back in the 18th century. And it's the birthday of John Agee, born in Nyack, New York, 1960, author of books for children and also a book of palindromes, phrases that read the same forward and backward. The title of the book was Go Hang a Salami, I'm a Lasagna Hog. It came out in 1991. Here's a poem for today by Robert Bly, People Like Us, for James Wright. There are more like us. All over the world there are confused people who can't remember the name of their dog when they wake up, and people who love God but can't remember where he was when they went to sleep. It's all right. The world cleanses itself this way. A wrong number occurs to you in the middle of the night. You dial it. It rings just in time to save the house. And the second story man gets the wrong address where the insomniac lives, and he's lonely, and they talk, and the thief goes back to college. Even in graduate school, you can wander into the wrong classroom and hear great poems lovingly spoken by the wrong professor, and you find your soul, and greatness has a defender, and even in death, you're safe. A poem by Robert Bly, People Like Us, from his collection Stealing Sugar from the Castle, published by W.W. Norton and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, a monthly devoted to discovering and publishing new voices in poetry. More at poetryfoundation.org. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
And you're tuned into Juno Afternoon. Today, our next guests are here to talk about the Alaskan Design Forum, which is happening tonight downstairs at M360 Studios. Judith Clark, a professor of fashion, and Adam Phillips, author of Becoming Freud and Unforbidden Pleasures. Thanks for coming down today.
Thank you for having us.
First of all, Judith, what is a professor of fashion?
What is a professor of fashion? It's like a made-up title, even though I actually am a professor, but people think it's sort of it's an anomaly too far. I study fashion and museology, and I teach a master's program in London on how to translate fashion into something that might be exhibited in the museum.
And you involve psychoanalysis in that?
Psychoanalysis is an inspiration largely through my relationship with Adam and conversations with him.
And Adam, you're an author, most recently, Becoming Freud and Unforbidden Pleasures. Can you tell me about the book, please?
Yeah. Unforbidden Pleasures was a book based on the idea that we have a very strong sense of the most exciting pleasures being the forbidden ones. And so it's as though all our language of pleasure and all the language of excitement seems to be about doing the forbidden thing. So Unforbidden Pleasures is a book about the importance in our lives of unforbidden pleasures. It could be as important to, as it were, enjoy your morning cup of coffee as to have an affair with somebody you shouldn't have an affair with. So the book makes a case for how significant unforbidden pleasures are in our lives.
Do you combine that with fashion as much as a student combines that with...
Well, what we've done two collaborations, a concise dictionary of dress and an exhibition called The Vulgar. And in both these cases, even though they're quite different in a way as exhibitions, we've tried to combine... the way we work together is that I produce a text that is, in a way, psychological, but also linked to ideas of space, imagery, and so on. So I produce a basic text, which I then give to Judith, and Judith uses as and when and where she wants to. So from the text, and when, of course, we've had a prior discussion, she uses the bits that are useful for the fashion exhibition or exhibition of dress that she's already, of course, thought about a great deal.
Tell me more about the dictionary.
Well, in the concise dictionary of dress, we chose about a dozen words. I then did brief definitions of them that were kind of aphoristic. I then gave them to Judith, and Judith used them to create what were effectively installations around the idea of dress. And this exhibition was, not incidentally, in a huge storage space in London called Blythe House, where the Victoria and Albert Museum, and indeed the British Museum, stored all the stuff they did not have on exhibition. So you would be taken around a kind of tour of this enormous storage house, and every so often there would be an installation. The installation entirely done by Judith, the text by me.
How long did it take you to put together?
Well, probably a combination of 10 years and a year. That's to say, it comes out of a longer conversation, but the actual exhibition was worked on for, I would say, about a year. Would you agree?
Yes. I mean, we did it with a wonderful organization based in London called Art Angel, which is a skeleton organization. And the wonderful thing that their directors do without a kind of urgency that sometimes filling permanent spaces provokes. It meant that you could talk as long as it took to kind of evolve the exhibition. And then when we were ready, we approached the Victoria and Albert Museum, and then the kind of real work of designing the installations actually began.
How did you get involved with fashion curation?
I trained as an architect, so that's my background. But I always had a craving, in a way, to make something of fashion. I didn't want to study fashion design, but I knew that I wanted to do something with it. And then when I was studying my master's in architecture, I happened to write my thesis on Russian avant-garde theatre. And suddenly the kind of constructivist architects work within the theatre, within textile design, experiments with gesture, with the idea of a body that could be dynamic and expressive in different ways, was always represented with still photographs. And it made them look like exhibitions. It made them look static in a way that in reality, of course, it was the theatre, so it wasn't. But nevertheless made a kind of everlasting impression on me that those were the kinds of exhibitions that I wanted to build, where fashion had a kind of manifesto-like meaning within a total environment. And so I've always worked in the round. I've always used my architectural background to inform something about the perception of the clothing. And of course, with exhibiting dress, it's always human scale, something which is so fundamental to architects. I mean, it's how we measure everything. And so you can play with that within exhibitions of dress because, of course, you're clothing this strange surrogate body that is the mannequin.
Can you go into a little bit more detail about maybe one or two pieces that you've designed?
Well, of exhibitions that I've designed, I think that examples of a kind of playfulness in respect to the exhibition that Adam described before, the Concise Dictionary of Dress. So, for example, there was a Greek designer called Sofia Kokosalaki, who designed kind of wonderful draped clothing, but the press always described her as kind of her Grecian goddess dresses. It was a kind of relentless kind of closing down of, in a way, of the references associated with her work. And so for that exhibition, when we were talking about storage, the exhibition being in a storage facility, I had the dress carved in stone, and so as if to remember the kind of classical reliefs. So I play on the material that is supposedly being exhibited, but sometimes is actually replaced by me within the installation.
Can you talk about the vulgar exhibition? Is it designed to be vulgar and titillate?
Well, if you call an exhibition the vulgar, of course, it is in itself a provocation. Our idea about this was quite simple, I think, which was that vulgarity tends to be an accusation. In other words, we don't want to think of ourselves as vulgar. And so it seemed that one way of thinking about this was that as though vulgarity was the scapegoat of good taste. So in order to have an idea of good taste, you had to have an idea of vulgarity. So the so-called vulgar were doing a great deal of work sustaining the owners of good taste, because the owners of good taste would say, vulgar is what we are not. The other thing that's interesting about vulgarity is that people think they know it immediately when they see it. So there is an absolute certainty in the people who claim to understand these things that they know what is vulgar. And the question is, what do they know when they know something is vulgar? So for us, and it's partly, of course, being, at least in my case, being English, it's very much to do with class. It's to do with class and it's to do with sexuality, effectively. Because originally, and it's a very interesting word, the vulgar simply meant the common people. So the vulgar tongue was the language spoken by everybody. By the late 18th century, vulgar was a term of disparagement and abuse. So the vulgar referred to the lower orders. So something that went from being something in common went from being something actually very, very undesirable to a certain group of people. So I then wrote texts about what the word vulgar is used to do, not by definition, a definition of the vulgar, because the definitions are the problem. So we were really trying to show how people use the word vulgar and what they're using it to do. So I then wrote the texts, and Judith then worked out the installations in terms of dress and the history of dress.
I'm talking with Judith Clark and Adam Phillips. Your talk tonight for the Alaska Design Forum at 6 o'clock in the 360 Studios. Sean Boyle is also in the room. Thanks for coming by, Sean.
Hey, Chef.
Can you tell me more about why you picked these people to come?
Well, you know, the mission at the Alaska Design Forum since the early 90s, I think 93 was the year Design Forum really kicked off, is to bring the world, the outside world of thought, culture, and design to Alaska in some way. And I think that as we've just heard in this conversation, it's a pretty sophisticated way of thinking about design and expressing that I think our guests are prepared to share with us this evening.
Tell me more about what you're going to be talking about tonight, please.
Okay, I don't want to give too much away, obviously, but I'm going to talk a bit about what psychoanalysis might help us understand about the idea of nostalgia. And in a way, it's very simple, which is, as everybody knows, whether they like psychoanalysis or not, psychoanalytic treatment is based on the understanding of the significance of childhood in relation to adult life. Well, nostalgia, of course, is about the past, and it's about how the past is used to sustain us in the present. So I'm going to be giving a series of psychoanalytic insights and ideas and thoughts and suggestions that shed some light on the way the word nostalgia is used, which hopefully then feeds into the more, in a way, substantial work that Judith is doing about nostalgia in terms of exhibition making.
Well, it starts tonight at 6 o'clock downstairs, and I believe there's a fee involved.
Yes, the Design Forum is, of course, a non-profit here in Alaska. We've got a make ends meet, but the basic fee is $15 per person. We have a $5 student fee and a $5 senior fee. And if, of course, you are truly painless and are really interested and engaged by what you heard today, come on down. We'll make it work for you anyway.
Adam, Judith, and Sean, thank you for coming by tonight.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you very much.
This is Bird Note. Thanks to a well-meaning but misguided soul, the house sparrow was first introduced into the U.S. from England in the 1850s, and it's now one of the most common birds in North America. The name house sparrow fits it well, because from Bangor, Maine to San Diego, British Columbia to the Panama Canal, and even in Hawaii, it's found nearly everywhere people live. A stocky little street fighter of a bird, it's fussy and vocal year-round. Sparrows often seem to be scrapping with each other, but still, they're always in a group, almost never alone. Sometimes a bush they've settled in seems to be alive with their chatter, even though you can't see a single bird. They even like to bathe together. True to their name, they prefer to nest in man-made structures or birdhouses, rather than in trees. And given a chance, they displace many of our native cavity-nesting birds from nest boxes. Emily Dickinson described the sparrow's nest as sweet of twigs and twine. There's a lot of both in a nest, because when sparrows find a cavity they like, they'll fill up every bit of space before laying their eggs. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
It's 30 minutes past the hour of our Juno afternoon. Our next guest in the studio is Lisa Doherty. She's involved in a new business called Juno Compost. Lisa, thank you for coming by the station today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So tell me, first, how would you define compost?
Compost is recycling your organic waste, like yard debris, food scraps, and paper, and turning it into a material you can use in your garden for fertilizer.
And what inspired you to start working with compost?
I guess I've just always composted since I've been a homeowner, and just seeing the magic of it happening on a larger scale, getting a hot pile going and seeing things transform really quickly. I just kind of wanted to share it with people, and yeah, that's what I'm doing.
Can you describe in maybe a little bit of detail what Juno Compost does?
Okay, yeah. Juno Compost is a curbside compost collection service, and it's serving pretty much all of town except out the road. And people collect their food scraps and yard debris and then set it out on Fridays to be collected, just like the trash, except it's not trash. It's going to be turned into compost that will then be available for the members who contributed their scraps. And then we also collect materials from cafes, restaurants, offices, or any other place to looking to decrease their waste, and services once or twice a week, depending on how much you have. And then one service I'm looking forward to providing is for zero waste events. And so if you have a fundraiser or some kind of public event where there are food scraps generated, you can just have a one-time pickup and reduce what you're sending to the landfill.
So you give or people supply their own 5-gallon bucket?
People can buy a bucket from me, or they can provide their own buckets. And for events, I have the buckets.
And tell me about the rates.
The rates vary. $25 a month will get you pickup service once a week if you're a resident. But there's varying rates. If you pool in with your neighbors, you can get down to as low as $7 a month.
How much research did you do to get into the business?
Well, I ran a pilot project for over a year back in 2012, and a lot of research came from reading, but most of it came from experience and finding what worked and what worked for businesses, what worked for people, also worked in the science of composting, what kinds of materials I needed to collect and how I needed to manage them in order to have a good product and to have something that wouldn't be a nuisance.
How many 5-gallon buckets do you plan on filling?
You know, Juno can fill as many as they want. I think the sky's the limit. I think this is just a good starting point to get people thinking about composting, because I think it's been on people's minds for a long time, and I think we've been kind of waiting for curbside composting, maybe from a city's municipal service sort of thing, like the trash or like recycling. And I'm just going to start 5 gallons at a time and see where we go.
Do you have a website?
I do, yeah. It's at junocompost.com, and there's also a Facebook page as well.
How long have you been in business?
Just a couple weeks. I've only done 2 Fridays of pickups so far, and, summer's right around the corner, so what a great time to start.
How do people get in touch with you?
They can go to the website, and there's a link there, or you can email junocompost@email.com. Or you could also call my house. It's 789-1283.
All right. Thanks very much. Is there anything you'd like to add that I ask?
No, I think that's it. Thanks for having me.
I had a turkey dinner, threw the bones away. They hauled them to the county dump without delay. By the following Thanksgiving, they had turned to clay. They're biodegradable garbage. Good garbage breaks down as it goes. That's why it smells bad to your nose. Bad garbage grows and grows and grows. Garbage is supposed to decompose. Styrofoam is bad, it lasts 1,000 years. A packing peanut's born and never disappears. So crumple up your comics when you ship your chandeliers. Cause comics are biodegradable garbage. Good garbage breaks down as it goes. That's why it smells bad to your nose. Bad garbage grows and grows and grows. Garbage is supposed to decompose. Every time that we buy food, we also buy the package. Bottles, boxes, bags, and cans, they end up in the garbage. Half of all our cash we're spending on our trash. For the sake of Mother Earth, let's get our money's worth. Only buy biodegradable good garbage. Breaks down as it goes. That's why it smells bad to your nose. Bad garbage grows and grows and grows. Garbage is supposed to decompose. Good garbage.
Six minutes past the hour, and you're tuned into June afternoon. Our next guest is Paul Hackenmiller. He's involved with a group of people who put the past prosperity together. Paul, thank you very much for being on the show with me today.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me, in a nutshell, what is past prosperity?
Past prosperity is a competition designed to identify and support sustainable triple bottom line businesses in Southeast Alaska.
How did it get started?
Got started about 5 years ago, so we just opened our fifth cycle. It's the result of a partnership between Spruce Root Community Development, where I work, and the Nature Conservancy. And both TNC and Spruce Root really were interested in cultivating an atmosphere and a culture of sustainably minded, triple bottom line focused small businesses in Southeast Alaska that make sustainable use of local natural resources and can have a positive social and cultural impact on their communities, as well as be, you know, profitable place-based businesses here in Southeast.
Sounds like you want to talk to the people who are doing the composting.
I think that I probably should talk to the people who are doing the composting, yes.
What's your goal?
So our goal is, as I said, generally to support businesses, sustainable businesses in Southeast Alaska. This year specifically, we've changed the program a little bit, and we're targeting food businesses exclusively. So this year we'd like to see entrepreneurs or people who have a good business concept involving food, whether that's growing, harvesting, processing, aggregating, distributing or preparing food somewhere in Southeast Alaska. We'd like to really get behind supporting local food security, local food systems. It's important to us at Spruce Root and at the Nature Conservancy.
Tell me more about Spruce Root, please.
Spruce Root Community Development is a nonprofit loan fund. We're based here in Juneau, but our footprint extends all over Southeast Alaska. We are tasked with providing support to small businesses here in Southeast, and we do that through two services. One is by access to capital. So we can lend. We're a loan fund. We can provide debt capital to entrepreneurs and small businesses who might not be able to access it from their regular bank, maybe because they're a startup or because they don't have much operating history or they're poorly collateralized. And we can work with these entrepreneurs to build their capacity to where we can hopefully finance them and support them in that way. And the other piece of support we provide is technical assistance. This competition, Path to Prosperity, is one example of that. But we also work one-on-one with small business owners that come in. We help them build their financial literacy, you know, build projections, work through a business plan, really just provide any resources that we can connect them with to help them be more successful in the future.
Is there such a thing as an average loan?
There is, you know, for us, you know, we're a pretty small loan fund. A lot of the businesses we work with are pretty small. So we like to say that every loan is different, and we work with each borrower to meet them where their needs are.
About how much money are we talking about?
So we're currently capped at $250,000. You know, a lot of our loans are in the neighborhood of, you know, 60 to 80, I would say, 80,000 for 5 years.
So this fifth year that you've done it, what kind of examples of projects you've funded look like?
So, you know, we've worked with a number of commercial fishing businesses, some people who are involved in, you know, forestry, silviculture work, forest management across the region, some tourism-related businesses. We're growing, but there's been a lot of interest and a lot of exciting activity on that front as well.
What advice would you give potential borrowers?
So for borrowers, I would say come talk to us. If you feel like you're in a place where you'd like to start a business and you need some capital to get started, give us a call. Visit our website at spruceroot.org, and you can learn a little more about the loan program. And really the best way is just to talk to us about our process. You know, is a little more face-to-face on the front end than maybe with a bank because of the time we spend developing that business plan. So I would, you know, encourage people to reach out to us directly, and just we'll have a chat about where you're at with your business and see how we can plug in. And maybe this competition is a good place for you to start.
But how many loans have you given out over the past 5 years?
So we're at about 10 loans. You know, we've been growing slowly, but we've seen a lot of activity really over the last 6 months or so, and that number should be much bigger here very soon.
Cool. Anything you'd like to add?
You know, on the Path to Prosperity, the business competition front, I'd say that we really are excited to bring support to food businesses in Southeast Alaska, and the deadline for applications is May 31st. You don't have to have an existing business to apply for this competition. We're really looking to support, you know, people who do have a going concern, but also new entrepreneurs who are interested in developing a concept. So that initial application is very conceptual for the Path to Prosperity, and we're really looking to get a feel for your business idea and for you to prove to us that you've put some thought into it. So we're looking for applications by May 31st, and again, you can visit www.spruceroot.org to learn more about the competition and to apply.
And after they apply, it's not a rock hard deadline. You're willing to work with these loan people who are looking for loans.
So the loan program is separate from the competition. So you can be a borrower coming to us for a loan and never have show any interest in the Path to Prosperity competition, then that's fine. We'll work with you as a borrower. Or you can come to us looking for support as a small business through the Path to Prosperity and not be interested in the loan program, and we're perfectly happy with that as well.
How do people get in contact with you?
www.spruceroot.org. There's an initial intake form for the loan program. There's some contact fields to get in touch with us about the competition. That's probably the best way.
Paul Hackenmuller, thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you.
The Juneau Audubon Society will sponsor two 2017 cruises to Berners Bay on Saturday, April 29th and May 13th at 8:30 a.m. Stellar sea lions, harbor seals, bald eagles, humpback whale, and tens of thousands of gulls are just some of the species observed this time each year. All vessels depart from Stater Harbor. Audubon members will be on board to act as naturalist guides. Tickets for the four-hour cruise are available at Hearthside Books with student and youth rates available. Don't miss it. The Juneau Audubon Berners Bay Cruises, April 29th and May 13th.
This is Paula Terrell from the Year of Kindness Steering Committee. As part of 17YOK, all sorts of groups are adopting specific weeks during which they do something to help spread kindness. This week's group is All Fun, No Guilt Book Club. You could sign up for a week by emailing 17YOK@junopolice.com. Together, we can make Juneau a better place to live.
Top spaceman.
And some music that's coming to town soon in the studio. Mary and Colin Pat Race. Mary, you want to talk to me about that music, please?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I'm part of a sort of a collective of really nerdy musicians who like to do silly projects together. That was a project I did with my friends Molly Lewis and Seth Boyer. We wrote a tribute to Randall Monroe, who does XKCD. He's writing descriptions of spaceships using only the 1,000 most commonly used words. And so we did Space Oddity using only the 1,000 most commonly used words, and we made a video of it. It was fun. So those friends, along with the Double Clicks, are coming to town, and we're doing a concert here at KTOO downstairs in Studio 360.
That's happening Saturday?
Yes, that is Saturday. It's at 1 p.m., and it's a kids' show. It's a family show. So everyone's invited, especially the kids. It's going to be some silly songs and sing-alongs. And yeah, there will be dinosaurs. There will probably be robots and spaceships. It's going to be a good time. And we're going to have live drawing, too, by some of our guests from Alaska Robotics Minicon. Kazu Kibuishi, who created the Amulet series, is going to be live drawing during the show, so everyone can see. That should be fun. And I think we'll have Lucas Elliott there, too, and maybe some other illustrators.
Tell me more about the Double Clicks.
The Double Clicks are actually quite a famous band now. They're a sister act. They're two sisters from Portland, and they are dry and witty and hilarious, and they have done songs about every single topic imaginable. Some of their latest songs are Girls Know Math, and Dinosaurs Are Just Really Big Chickens, and one of my eternal favorites is Clever Girl about velociraptors. They're a lot of fun. And they're coming to town for their first time for this show on Saturday at 1 o'clock. We're all going to be in a lineup together. And we've also asked Fish, local musician Fish, Theo Hook, to join us, which should be fun. Tickets for that are at ktoo.org, I should say. And they're about a third sold out already, so there's plenty left, but you might want to grab them.
All right. Pat Race, you're in the studio here.
I am. I'm right here in the studio with you. And and the event that Marian is talking about is going to be wonderful. I'm very excited about it, especially the live drawing. We are doing a comic convention this weekend, and so one of the things about comic conventions is that they've kind of grown into these celebrations of popular culture and contemporary art, and so they have become much more than just comics. They've become about games and about music and about all of the things that sort of surround comics, and so it's fun for us to Aaron Suring and I have been exhibiting at a lot of comic conventions over the last several years, and it's fun for us to bring the idea of a comic convention to Juneau and just try and execute that on a very, very, very small scale. And so we have a concert, and we have board game setups, and you know, the guys from Platypus will be down doing board games, and we've got a little convention floor with a whole bunch of vendors and book signings, and we're bringing in special guests from outside of Juneau, and it sounds like we're going to have artists from I think as many as 30 to 40 different cities here. It's just a kind of a big, exciting thing downtown here. We've got a kickoff event. We do this in partnership with the Friends of the Juneau Public Libraries. And so we have a kickoff event on Friday evening out there. At 4 o'clock, there's going to be a free screening of Jason and the Argonauts if anyone wants to show up early and do some sketching based on the film.
It's a classic movie.
It is, yeah. And it's
at the Mendenhall Valley Library.
Oh, yeah, sorry, did I say? Yeah, Mendenhall, sorry, that's at the Mendenhall Valley Library. And then at 6 p.m. is when our kickoff event starts, and that's kind of a chance for us to introduce our guests. And it's a little bit of a musical variety show with a whole bunch of very short presentations. So maybe someone reads a book or does a little radio drama or something.
And this is the second year you've done this?
This is the second year we've done this, and it's going to be similar to the first. We actually have a lot of guests coming back because they like Juneau so much.
Yeah, they
really
enjoyed last year, and they all wanted to come back again. So we've got Raina Telgemeier is back again, and Kazuki Buishi. Ryan North has come back again. And Kate Beaton is back. Yeah, it's kind of amazing. It's like the entire New York Times graphic novels bestseller list is here in town in the same weekend. We better treat them right. It should be fun.
What kind of things identify the zine, the modern zine?
The modern zine. I guess, I don't know, are you talking about comic books or zines? Like, zine culture is very different, I think, than comic book culture, but they're certainly run parallel to each other. Zines are there probably will be some zines there this weekend. They are more about, like, independent self-publishing, getting out voices that may not be heard through traditional publishing routes. They're very, very usually much more personal. Down to earth, a lot like what you do with the Real Alaska Magazine. I mean, that's actually a good example of. I mean, I would say that your magazine that you create is kind of on the upper end of zine culture as far as production value goes.
I think it would. What's going to be fun is we'll have a lot of events that are for fans of comics, like signings and like screenings. We're doing some movies down at the Gold Town, some other Ray Harryhausen movies, and talks about movies at the Downtown Library. But there will also be events that are for sort of interested and amateur artists. Like we're going to have drawing time over at Zach Gordon Youth Center with some of our guests illustrating in the afternoon. So go hang out at Zach Gordon and do some drawing. There's also some talks on art and intellectual property, doing research that are kind of for local creators here in Juneau.
Actually, a really important part of what we're doing is one of the people we're bringing in is her name's Katie Lane, and she specializes in like work for hire, like helping artists develop contracts, and she works with comic book artists and other independent creators to make sure that their rights are being respected and that they are approaching, because a lot of times they're so busy with the art they don't necessarily cover the business side of the business, and so she's a great resource who will be here to learn from.
Did she put together a little publication about the Grand Canyon?
I don't know if she did. That's a question I cannot answer. You've stumped me, Jeff Brown.
I think this is where the money was involved somehow, more than just buying or selling something.
Yeah, I don't know if she did something on the Grand Canyon, but she's an expert lawyer and has done a lot of work with creative types. So if you're interested, she's doing a workshop, and you can come meet her, and we'll have some workshops on, like, inking and writing comedy. Kate Beaton and Ryan North are going to be leading a workshop on that, and it should be very entertaining and educational at the same time.
Mm-hmm. And this all happens one day or 2 days?
Well, the kickoff event is on Friday, this Friday at 6 p.m., and then on Saturday from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. is the convention. And it's all free thanks to the support and partnership with the Friends of the Juneau Public Library.
And we have events kind of all over downtown. Like, the Jack is going to be the main show floor center, and the Jack Gallery will have events back there too. And then there's drawing at Zach Gordon Youth Center, and there's going to be shows at the Goldtown Nickelodeon. There's going to be a lecture by some folks who do puppetry over at Leica Stop Motion about filmmaking and about puppets.
It's a lot to pack into one radio interview.
It is, but it's going to be amazing.
If people are interested, the whole schedule of events is online. You can go to minicon.alaskarobotics.com, and we're excited to share all of our guests with the community.
All right. Pat Race and Marion Call, anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
I just want to invite people to grab tickets in advance for the one thing that we have tickets for. That's the concert Saturday at 1 p.m. right here at KTOO. You can get tickets at KTOO.org. I think it's $5 for kids and $10 for adults. It's likely to be a nice full house, so go ahead and grab those in advance.
And we're going to take another sample. Listen, this is kind of number two.
This is a project that I did together with the Double Clicks. We did a schoolhouse rock song together, Conjunction Junction. You'll hear them playing and singing along with me. We had a very good time making it.
All right. Anything you'd like to add?
Oh, I'm excited to hear the song.
Thanks for coming by.
Yeah.
Thank you, Jeff.
Junction, what's your function?
Hooking up words and phrases and closes.
Conjunction, junction, how's that function?
I got three favorite cars, get most of my job done.
Conjunction, junction, what's your function?
I got and, but, and, or, they'll get you pretty far.
And,
that's additive, like this and that.
But
that's sort of the opposite, not this, but that.
Oh.
And then there's or, O-R, for when you have a choice, this or that. And, but, and, or get you pretty far.
Conjunction, junction, what's your function?
Hooking up two boxcars and making them run right. Milk and honey, bread and butter, peas and rice.
Hey, that's nice.
Dirty but happy, digging and scratching, losing your shoe and a button or two. Poor but honest, sad but true.
Boo hoo hoo. Conjunction, junction, what's your function?
Hooking up phrases and clauses, the balance like. Out of the frying pan and into the fire. He could loose the sandbags, but the balloon wouldn't go any higher. Let's go up to the mountains or down to the sea. You should always say thank you, or at least
say please.
Uh-huh.
Conjunction, junction, watch that function. Gonna get you there if you're very careful. Conjunction, junction, watch that function. Gonna get you there if you're very careful.
This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas.